backwards, which does make sense to me. The backwards is you look at the chapter and take it apart first before you decide to start the title in it. And that's what we're going to do together today. I have on the board intuitive and analytical. And if I can find my glasses, which I'm always busy, I'll tell you why. That is just a part of thinking. It's a part you could use if you were studying a book. I liked what N.T. Wright, who is a theologian, said. He says, "I was a musician before I was a theologian," says N.T. Wright. "When I look at a piece of music, my mind is making connections between harmonic shifts. I'm seeing the pattern in song. When I'm reading passages, I'm asking, how do the themes crisscross like a symphony? The Bible is no different. There are there is harmony, there's disjointed, there is story, which we talk about story all the time. And so for us, what we're going to do is learn how to dig those out." He also goes on to say that as we become familiar with Scripture, we have questions about passages and their meaning. This is where true Bible study begins. He says there are two approaches to the Bible, intuitive and analytical, and so we're going to talk about that. If I asked you what is women's intuition, what does that mean?
Foreknowledge of something. You know, they sense it.
They sense it. It's a sensing. It's a going through the process. You're kind of in the middle of it. If you, how many times I've walked into a store and I see, somebody looking like they're about ready to burst out crying, my intuition tells me there's a problem. It seems logical to me, but 98% of men walk right by and don't even notice it. So intuitive is a picture of how we approach something. So going with the flow. And submerging yourself in the text. Now what we've done, those of you who took my structuring class, we did it analytically. What did we do in the structuring class? Broke down piece by piece. What was the purpose?
Get the meaning of what's being said.
Find out why the author wrote this book. Analytical is breaking it down piece by piece, and there's different pieces to it. Sometimes there's language to it. Sometimes there's story to it. Sometimes there is just passages that you're trying to understand the importance of. What he uses this example. He tells the story of a great violinist, and I'm not going to say the name right. Somebody here probably knows it. Yehudini Menuhin. By the time he was 16, he had played all the major violin concerts all over the world, and he was bored, which I can understand. We all know 16-year-olds. He set himself to analyze the concertos note by note until he understood why Beethoven put that phrase there and how it related to the whole structure. Only when he had done this would he play the concerto again, because now he had lived inside of it. To be the analytical, you're on the outside of the picture, and you're looking at the picture. And in that sense, we are trying to understand the mind of God and why he did what he did. So we're on the outside. Looking for the intuitive, we're on the inside, living. Now, I'm talking about a book of 1 Samuel. How would I be on the inside living it?
Well, Well, when you put yourself, when you're reading, and like as it starts out with the story of Hannah, mm-hmm. and you don't, I mean, you do read through to quickly to get the overall view, but you also read slowly to try and imagine what would that have been like, you know, for Hannah.
And in actuality, all of them. You start with those characters. Who are the characters in the first few chapters? Right. You've got her husband. You've got that woman who's hurting her.
Yeah.
You've got words about them. You've got Hannah's pain. Is she just in pain about the not having children? Is there more pain than that? So when you come into a book intuitively, you place yourself into the story.
And you're letting yourself be touched
right.
by it, by the
right.
peoples, by the story, by the events that happened.
Because God has chosen those particular stories. Do we know everything about Hannah?
No.
This is all we know. So he has a purpose in this story and why he said it. Do we know anything about her husband? Why is he there? What part is he playing? What is the outcome? When we come into the next chapters, we're going to meet Eli and his sons. And we're going to see huge contrast between Eli's sons and Samuel, and we need to be thinking, why? How did this happen? How did it come about? Because we're going to come to a verse when Samuel's been a pretty good kid, ministering in the temple of God, but he did not know God, and he had not yet heard him. And then I'm going to say, well, how did he do this other stuff if he didn't have that? And how are these two guys doing what they're doing, knowing full well they've heard the word of God since they were young? They are right in the middle of the temple. So that's intuitive. You put yourself in the story. In all history, you put yourself in the story. If you don't put yourself in the story, you're looking at it from the outside and you'll never understand it. And then when we go analytically, actually what we're doing is looking at the text. Why did God choose these stories? What is he trying to teach us? And we start taking it apart from that picture. Okay, so it's about Samuel. It's Samuel's story. Why did he start with Hannah's situation first? Why didn't she go, her story go all through the book? I mean, these are things that we, to understand what God is trying to teach us in the text, you have to get behind the text. And let's see, what else do I want to do? So we do that by asking, how did this, questions are, how did, how does this text and what are the main themes? What is going on? Can you ask what is going on up here? Is coming in, I'm wondering about the people, what is going on. And then down here, I'm wondering, why is God using this? What is going on? What is he trying to teach me? So he has taken us, not only we want to know God personally, but about him. We have to go past just the words. We have to start getting into the mind of God. And we do that by seeing what he is presenting and what he's unfolding into our lives. You guys have questions? Sure you do. You'll have more when we get through. Get in there. So why would it be important, do you think, to use both methods?
To get both of your understanding?
Because we're not just understanding the story, we're understanding God's story and why he put in it. The theme goes all the way through the Bible. You've got the theme of who God is and why he did it. When you think of Genesis, is Genesis just about Adam and Eve? it's a lot bigger picture because we start before he even creates them. So you start with God, and then you start to see the people brought in, and you begin to understand God in relationship and why he does these kinds of things. So as we've talked in the past, you want to understand why each book was different than another book, because it is. You go into the New Testament, and every book has its purpose. And we usually look for that by looking for its key themes or key words or key verses. But if I were to try and learn about salvation, what book would I go to if the whole book is about?
Romans.
The book of Romans is about salvation. If you don't read Romans, you're not going to understand salvation. You get a very superficial picture of throwing out the gospel to a few people that you walk by and expect their whole life to change. But if you don't understand what the gospel really is and have a handle on that, you're not going to be able to answer questions to people. Well, what book do I go to if I want to learn about the Lordship of God?
It's Charlene. She's whispering over here.
Part of it's in Ephesians.
Okay, how would Ephesians break down?
Because it shows us how God prepared the Jews to receive the Gentiles as part of the church.
So the church is being built, and that's what I would actually more think of Ephesians as, is the book that builds the church. If I go through the Gospels, what are the difference between the four Gospels? Well, who's Matthew written to?
Jews.
Why? How do you know that?
Because he is showing Jesus as the Messiah.
And he starts right out in chapter 1 doing that and giving his background, right? And then he proceeds to go through the whole picture developing Jesus as that promised one to the Jewish people. How about Mark? It's a shorter book, almost by half. Well, right. By half of what that is.
Right, and he's giving what he perceives as the main events, and going through it quickly. You have to know this about it. You have to know this is what he's saying, and so he uses immediately a lot, and just he's giving as concisely as he can what he thinks is very important.
And so he's really giving the picture of Jesus as a servant, Jesus as... So you begin to see it's the same Jesus, the stories are the same, but there's a different flavor to it. We go to Luke, it is definitely presented for the Gentile, who doesn't have that heritage. Luke didn't have that heritage. So you kind of look at it differently, and you have to build a foundation a little bit, which he does.
And Luke's is more meticulous. He gives a multitude of details in it. Who was in power? Who was doing this? What happened with the healings? How did this happen? He gets
so
a lot of details.
You get both of these, don't you? Mm-hmm. Luke writes a lot. You get that picture on both sides. You get the technical side, and you get the very personal in the middle of the story side, which he was.
And that's because he was writing to a Greek. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Who didn't have the background that the Jews had. So they're going to have to learn the parts of the background that apply to them. And then we go to other books in the Bible, Galatians, even Romans, where the Jews come in and try and make them all become little Jews now. And that's thrown out and not accepted, and Ephesians does that. And so we begin to start getting this bigger picture that we, in many ways, are part of, and we can watch that. Why John?
Because of the agnostics. He's showing that Jesus is God. Mm-hmm. That's today the problem with many false cults. Jesus is not God to them.
It is, he isn't. Gnosticism hasn't quite come in. It's the pre-Gnosticism that's there. Mm-hmm. And Colossians really points to that too. But Jesus, when Jesus is presented in John, you get to know him as a man, as well as God, and he touches your heart in a way that nothing else does. It's not just a story. It's a very real picture of somebody that I can know and who I can sit at the feet of and learn from. So, and then we have Revelation. What is Revelation about? About the second coming. What else? About the church. What is it doing with the church? Why and where is it in the book that it talks about the church? So why would it be in the beginning?
Because it's important for the church to know what, how to center on Christ, who is the center of the church.
And then he takes
what they've done wrong and how to correct.
Right. And so he's pointing that out from the early stages. And but it even starts back in chapter 1 with what picture?
Jesus, he's giving the revelation. John gives him this vision of what he saw.
Illuminated. Jesus is illuminated. His glory is powerful. And the statement is being made in chapter 1 that is learned through the whole rest of the book. Even though Jesus has died, he hasn't. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is, and when we finish, the church ends up where it's supposed to have been in the first place. So the book of Revelation is that exposure. It is not, never, never to sit on the eschatology or the prophecy of it. It's to get to know Jesus in all of this. The end is he's one. You know, he's one. And as young Christians, we as the church will often hone in on prophecy and forget about living today for the Lord Jesus Christ. Getting to know him, getting into his story. We keep transposing ourselves out of it and not having to live like Christian church did.
So many too are trying to explain the symbolism in there.
Right. So if you do, well, even if they could, which it changes with every generation, that's not the point of that book. It is not the point of that book, and if you don't know how to look for it, you get lost in all these details and miss that Jesus is God, that he has sat down on the right hand of God, that he is in charge of all history. This stuff is all light and peripheral in comparison, and if we spend our whole Christian life on any one aspect, we miss the big picture of God. So today we're going to start with Samuel, and what we're going to do, which is what we usually do whenever you start a book, is listen to it. So we're going to listen to it, and then we're going to divide, and I have to listen to it. I'm not sure how I'm going to do this, so we'll
city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Ophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he gave portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart. Only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you. But Hannah answered, No, my lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. Then Eli answered, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him. And she said, Let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. They rose early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel, for she said, I have asked for him from the Lord. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him, so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine. And she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, Oh, my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence, praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there.
Okay, let's just look at that chapter for a minute. Who's in that chapter? Okay, we have watching this, we haven't really gotten into this story yet. Who else is in this story?
The other wife.
The other wife. Spell her name for me.
P-E-N-I-N-N-A-N-A-H.
Sure, I spelled that wrong. Okay. Who else is in this story?
Eli.
Eli.
Yeah, Eli. Okay. I don't have room to do what I'm going to encourage you to do, but go ahead. Who else?
Hophni and Phinehas.
Hophni and Phinehas. Are they in this story?
No, it mentions them as all.
Well, pretty much all characters in the book. I mean, that we're going to look at. Anyone else?
Samuel.
Samuel. Okay. So, as you look at this first chapter, who does the story seem to be about? It does seem to be about Hannah, doesn't it? What are we learning about her?
She's barren.
She's barren.
Her husband loves her more than the other one.
Think the other one might know that?
Yes.
And she's praying to the Lord for a child.
So she's a praying person.
She's distressed not only because she's barren, but because she's been picked on.
So she has actually two crosses to bear, so to speak. Okay. What did you learn? What did you learn about her praying in this chapter? If you were there watching her, you're also in the temple. She's not in the inner temple. I'm not sure where she is. Very emotional.
Well, intuitively, I don't think I'd assume right off she was drunk.
We're not a man.
We're not a man. It's like,
why wouldn't you assume she's drunk? For one thing, drunks don't act violently as much as they act lethargic. I mean, they do if something's coming up.
Yeah. She's so distressed, and as a woman, you can understand distress.
Isn't it interesting? God shows us that. Yeah. Because I don't think most men would get that. I think they mostly think the way Eli thought. What else is on that? Well, we haven't seen all that yet, okay. So if I were looking at this chapter, I would learn... What do I learn about her husband, Elkanah?
He loved her dearly.
Let's go back to verse 1.
He's an Ephraimite.
This is background here. This is background.
He's the tribe of Ephraim.
He's an Ephraimite, which makes Samuel what?
Ephraimite.
Also an Ephraimite. Keep that in mind, because who are the priests?
Levites.
They're Levites. Okay.
Oh,
yeah. We're getting into the story here, and if you were Jewish, you'd know that, right? But, you know, we have to actually have that hit us in the... I got it yesterday. I was looking at that thing.
He's not a Levite.
He's not a Levite. So he had two wives, and we learn that there is a dispute between the two. Now, where would you break this chapter down? Where does there seem to be a transition in thought? How do you find transitions in thought?
Because the numbers are highlighted here on my
screen. Well, somebody thought they belonged to the... What's in front of those numbers? Mm-hmm. Or behind those numbers in the text?
Words like then and now.
Very good. Because those are transitional words. So I start paying to those time words. It's actually a time word that's in transition. And the book starts with now. So it's in transition from where it was before. And the second transition, or the next transition, comes in 3, which says, now this man will go up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice. Who are we talking about here?
The husband.
We're talking about the husband.
Yeah.
And where do they go?
To Shiloh.
Shiloh. Where are they not going?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. Interesting. Okay, so we're observing that. And then we get into the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests to the Lord there. When the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, whatever her name is, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he would give double portion, for he left. So who is this section about? It's about Elkanah, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Yeah.
How come there, okay, gave portions to his wives and all of her sons and daughters? Weren't they his sons and daughters too?
Yes, but if you have multiple wives like that, they are considered, that's why Israelites, Jewish people always went through the line of the mother, because there may have been a father there, but that doesn't mean that all his children were brothers, full brothers and sisters. So they pay attention to the wives as well. So he gave double portions. This is about him. So what would I title this section? And let's figure out where it stops. I'd have year after year, often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her, so she wept and would not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart so sad? Am I not better? So that is a section that you will come up with themes. What are the themes in verses 3 through 8? And theme just means, what did you read about? Who's it about?
Elkanah.
It's about Elkanah, and it's going to make a transition. In verse 9, who's the transition to?
Hannah.
It's to Hannah. So you have Elkanah, Hannah, and then we learn she rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh, and now Eli the priest is sitting on his seat beside the doorpost. So we're going to learn about Eli the priest, too, and so we want to pay attention to him as a person, because God is being very specific about who he's bringing into this story. We learn about Elkanah and his two wives, and the problem that's going on between them. We are now learning about Hannah. So he's doing this. He starts with the big picture, and he's doing this. But he hasn't told us yet what this whole book is about. We know because it says 1 Samuel, but they didn't know that. Okay, so he's doing this, and God has his purposes. So we come to... So you get to think about what 3 through 8 is and write it down. Then Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost in the temple of the Lord. She was greatly distressed and prayed to the Lord. So now we begin to see a picture of Hannah and really her response to the first part of the story. She wept, she prayed, she wept, and she bowed. And she bowed to who?
To the Lord.
Through all this. You're not learning this yet.
Okay, Lord of hosts.
She bowed to the Lord, and what did she ask? She said, if you indeed look on the affliction. Now, she must have been doing this in her head, because what is Eli seeing?
Just her mouth moving.
Mm-hmm. So, if you look on the affliction of your maidservant. So, she prayed, she wept, and she bowed. She said, asked to him to look on the affliction of her, remember her, do not forget her, but to give your maidservant a son. And then I will give him to the Lord. That is an amazing thing. She's waited a long time for this child, and she's going to give him back to him. All the days of his life, and a razor shall never come in his head. Now it came about, so we hit verse 12. And we've got it separated again because of the word now. So what is verse 9 through 11 about? I'm sitting in the middle of this. I'm there in this place with Hannah. What am I seeing? I'm seeing her pray.
Intensely, but she's not moving. She's not saying anything out loud. Just her lips are moving.
Okay, but we haven't gotten to that yet.
She's distressed.
She's weeping bitterly. And by the way, I'm reading this in ESV. One of the suggestions when you do Bible study is have two Bibles so that you're getting different perspectives on certain things. So far, they found exactly the same. I'll show you where they're different. She's praying. She's weeping. We can see that. We can't see the bow. So we've entered into her prayer world with God. And we're seeing what she said, and we're seeing what's on her heart. Then we go now, verse 12. She continued praying. Eli is watching her mouth. I think that's weird all by itself, but
yeah.
I guess because, like you said, she's distressed. As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart. Only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. And Eli said, how long will you make yourself a drunk? Put away your wine. Now, this is an interesting thing for any of you who have read any further in this story at all. Here, Eli is chastising her.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it. He's chastising her for drinking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Hannah replied, "No, my lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord." That's a good picture, isn't it? She is pouring something, but what is she pouring? She took what he said, and she used what he said in the illustration of her life. She isn't pouring wine. This is not what the outcome of this is. It's her heart. And her soul. Then she says in verse 16, "Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation." Those are two interesting words. She is speaking out of two things, concern and provocation. And I am going to think about that to think what she's talking about. And then Eli said, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you your petition that you have asked of him." And she said, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. Why? I'm going to ask. I'm sitting there watching her. Why is her face no longer sad? What just happened in her life? What has God presented to me that I can see? I can see a woman who came in anguish. What did she do in her anguish? Poured out her heart silently, but with moving lips, evidently, before God. We get to see what she says. Eli comes in, finds out what really is going on, and he has a response that he says, "Go in peace and may the God of Israel." So here's Eli, even though he's not a very good priest, he is still serving this woman, because this woman is receiving it as from the Lord. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. He's gotten used to seeing his drunken sons, for one, and other people come in. There's not a great deal of spirituality going on where he is, and he's forgotten. And then he sees her come in and like,
I think I've told you guys the story years ago. She'd asked me some questions, and I basically ended up witnessing to her. And the next day, she went and visited her friend who was in jail. And this guy is just in anguish for being there, for what he had done. And she was talking to him, and she said, "I know what you want, and I know what you need. My sister told me about it yesterday," and she actually gave him the gospel and he got saved. Now, my sister wasn't saved. I always sort of picture her like a donkey talking the words to them. So it isn't necessarily, I'm not saying that you get to just be sloppy, but it isn't necessarily the presenter. It's the gospel that changes life. It's God's word that changes life. And so that happened here. So I want to think about, if I'm sitting there watching this, how this terribly ungodly man can still be used by the Lord to accomplish the Lord's will.
Is it normal for him to be where the women were?
I have no idea. That isn't part of the story, is it? Do they need priests? Yeah. It's not like a church, because in a church everybody would come in. There's the women's quarter. You're right. But at the same time, that was in the temple, wasn't it? This is not the temple. This is Shiloh. I don't know what's there. That's something that we didn't figure out with our class. Except for he's not in the temple. So we need to think about that. Look up what we can, learn what we can, but can't go past that. I just to know that he's in Shiloh, not Jerusalem. At least that's what it's saying here. So we can only take what we've got, and then we'll build on that and find out maybe it is something else. We don't know that yet. So then we have another transition. "Then they arose early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord and returned again to their house." So as you think about this couple, what kind of people are they?
Well, they seem to be following all the rules and regulations for the worship of that day.
Maybe that's just their heart. Because I think Eli was probably following the rules and regulations too. And Elkanah had relations with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And it came about in due time after Hannah conceived that she gave birth to a son and named him Samuel, saying, because I have asked of the Lord. This is the beginning of the introduction to Samuel. And then Elkanah went up with his household to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned. Then I will bring him, that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever. Now, weaning in our culture means one thing, is stop nursing the kid. That is not what this means here. It's more of a picture of, if you think of, who do I want to pull out? There are several stories in the Bible where we get the picture that the son is being raised by the mother to a certain point. Who are you?
Ishmael.
That's a whole different story.
And like 13.
This is more like probably somewhere between 7 and 13, because he's going to be called a certain thing later on, and that is a name that he's old enough to be actually fighting, but that's not what we're seeing here. We're still seeing it as a child, so these are confusing terms, but it just means it's time to hand him over to one who will train him for the rest of his life. And if we were in a culture that did that, it would be where mom had him to a point and then he became a man. And in the Jewish culture, that is 13.
I get down here on verse 23, it says,
well, she's still a baby there.
Okay. So we're just talking about then in verse 24, sometime later.
Right. Right. Whatever that is. And we really don't know, do we?
They made little coats for him, so
yeah.
As he was growing. So.
Well, that's why I said we'll look at these words and see what they mean as we go through it. Right now we're just trying to get a feel for the story. Right now what we're actually doing is doing the intuitive. We haven't really gotten into the analytical much. We will when we go back. Yes, she weaned him. She took him up with her with a three-year-old. When she had weaned him, she took him up with her in three old bowls, one ephah of flour and a jug of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, when the child was young. When you read verse 23, Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems to best you, remain until you have weaned him, only may the Lord confirm his word. And that little statement there is different in our version versus what the story said. It said it a little different. I understood it better on the tape than I understood it in the American Standard. So that looked like, well, maybe that isn't God's will and he's going to have to confirm it. That's not what it's saying. It's saying that God will confirm this. So they slaughtered the bull, brought the boy to Eli. Verse 26, oh my Lord, your native soul lives. My Lord, I am the one who stood beside you. So you have almost this cycle. She started out, she's ending up here. Praying to the Lord, for this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition when I asked of him. So I have dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. Who's the he? He's the son. So we're beginning to see the son coming out. So, if you were dividing chapter 1, and you could look at your big color numbers if you want to, what transitions are you getting? What feel are you getting? Where do we start the chapter?
We start with introducing Elkanah.
So we get his background and his history, and we seem to do this with the Jews a lot. You want to know who they are, and they aren't just this person. They're this heritage, aren't they? And his heritage goes back to what? So he's an Ephraimite. And then verse 2 goes into his presence. So we go from his heritage to his presence. His presence, he has two wives. One has children, one doesn't. So the chapter is laying itself out. This is what we'll be analyzing.
that's more or less his introduction of who he is. And then verse 3 transitions to what he does.
What does he do, Grace?
He goes yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh.
So what do you think God is showing us here?
What kind of man is he?
What kind of man is he?
He's
about. He does, as somebody else said earlier, he does what he's supposed to. Right, and provides for them to give this is what they're giving. So then it starts to get a little bit more into his household. What do we learn about his household?
His relationship with his wife.
And their relationship with each other. Doesn't tell us how he responds to this. Which I think is weird, but it's a different culture. Maybe that's what we have to figure out. This is a different culture. I think about all the different things I've read on, for instance, Middle Eastern homes that have multiple wives, and there does seem to be that flavor of competition that can be brutal, especially from the mothers. But fortunately, his mother's not here. You don't see her.
I'm just wondering, was Hannah maybe his first wife? She couldn't have kids, so he married the other
Could
wife.
Be.
We don't know.
Could be. It's not a biblical thing for them to have two wives, but we see from the very beginning that is often done because it is a cultural thing, and that we still see it today.
Well, to have children is so important for a man, even having more than two, but for a man as well.
Well, for children, they have children. For her, she would want the female too because they help her in do the female work. But
I just wondered because Hannah was mentioned first.
Could be.
But maybe she
could be
first wife, and she couldn't be children. Had to get another one.
Or chose to get another one. Because why? Because the line must go on.
Right.
Then you come down to his personal response to her in verse 8, and why do you think that is there?
I think it shows us a little bit more about compassion.
And their personal relationship. But what is he saying?
I want to be important in your life.
Aren't I enough?
What is he not understanding about her as a woman in that culture?
Her need for a child.
Her worth comes from it.
Her value is totally in reproduction. He doesn't see it because he has sons. Mm-hmm. It was about having a son.
And if something happens to him, she has no sons to provide for her.
Exactly.
It plays into we seem to be narrowing down to Samuel, and it plays into his willingness to let her give Samuel over to the temple at that point.
Could be. That's good.
I mean, it shows his attitude.
This is where we get into the story and start paying attention to it. It doesn't matter which son, as long as he has sons. But I also think he doesn't understand, for a man to say to her, aren't I better than 10 sons? Those are two entirely different subjects. Because in a culture, what is the child, especially a male child, to the woman?
Security.
It's her place in this culture. Without children, she has no place in this culture. She failed. Now, her husband doesn't see her as a failure, but he's not seeing her in the culture. He's just seeing her in the home.
Right.
So the other side of that story is, what is it for him? Why are I not as important and as valuable as 10 little babies? But he's not getting her pain.
Well, it's his way of trying to comfort her without having to address the problem. Like, tell the other wife to not be so mean.
Right.
That could have been done.
I think. Do you think?
I wish we could hear it. This is when I'd like to hear him speak and just instead of just seeing it written, because that line could be stated two or three different ways.
Exactly.
And with the different ways of stating it has a different impact on the relationship.
So what if just thinking about it, what might he be feeling?
He could be feeling rejected, but rejected. He may also just be trying to comfort her.
Mm-hmm. See, and so
probably depends on the husband you have.
Right.
Exactly. I would see my husband knowing it isn't good, but just trying to make me feel better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and again, he's got two wives. He does have children. He's just thinking big picture. She's being very specific. And he could be.
Either way, it's kind of oblivious to her feelings.
Right. Yeah. Right. And not knowing how to comfort that. How do you comfort that? It's kind of hard. Those of us who've known or are people who have not had children, that is just something that nobody else can really understand. Especially if that's what she wanted. She spent her whole life, her mommy and daddy taught her how to grow up and be a woman who was going to raise kids, and now she doesn't have any. And she's sure not going to be able to raise that other lady's kids. And she won't let her. So this is getting into the story, isn't it?
It kind of reminds me of Jacob and Leah and Rachel. Mm-hmm. Almost the same thing.
Very much so.
Favoritism to the wife that's more loved, but the wife not loved has the kids.
So neither one of them seems fair, does it? For those of us who are, you know, set on fair, it just doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem fair that she doesn't have children. It doesn't seem fair that they're not treating each other well. It doesn't seem, you know, doesn't seem fair that the husband doesn't love the wife equally. But that would be pretty hard to do. So it doesn't seem fair that this culture allows two women in a marriage.
So does again, it actually state that he loved her more than the other wife? Mm-hmm. It states that she was given a double portion.
Right.
But I don't see, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm missing it, where it actually says that the reason why she's given a double portion is because she's loved more. It could be a guilt offering or whatever.
A piece at home offering?
Yeah, a piece at home offering. Yeah. I mean.
Well, he doesn't say he loves Anna.
It doesn't say he loves her? Okay.
No.
Well, he could be utterly frustrated. The other.
So what we're doing as we speculate is we're also trying to understand why God presented it this way. Why do you think God presented it this way? Besides the fact it's a true story. What's he trying to teach us? We may not have answers yet. This is something you may find out as you study this week. Okay?
Well, that God, in his way, can love us without giving us exactly what we want.
Mm-hmm. Oh, application. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he waits until we're ready for it, doesn't he?
And
when I first asked for it, I may be asking for very self-centered reasons.
And it can take years.
Because we're going towards Samuel in this, it sets up how Samuel ended up where he's at. Because if she'd had the first child, I mean, if she'd had a child early, would Samuel have been given over to the Lord and ended up in the church? And he was given with the distinct purpose of serving God.
Right.
So he had a purpose from the beginning.
Exactly. And part of it is he's seen how his parents respond to things. He's seen I'm sure he's seen in the time he was home when mom wanted something or dad wanted something, it would be God they would go to, not each other. So these are setting him up for, because we see him worshiping before he even knows who God is.
Mm-hmm.
And how does one do that? They do that by example, by what the example was. And so then I can take that back home and say, I can't make my children Christians, but I can be that example. I can be, or grandchildren, or whoever. I can be that example of pointing to the Lord as the solution, the answer, and who He is. You haven't even started studying yet. I like this guy. Well, I think it's hard to label the whole thing. I really honestly do. And I think that the best way to do it is actually, especially with history books, it helps me then really get into the parameters of the history. Why is God telling me this? And then later on, I go, oh, that's what was being talked about back then. And that makes it very helpful. Okay, so we've got her. And as somebody had pointed out earlier, that he was seated on the door. It says temple, on the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. So we want to figure out how Shiloh has the temple. She greatly distressed, praised the Lord and wept bitterly. Where do I want to go? Provocation, verse 16. We talked about concerning provocation. Those are two different words. We may want to look them up and figure out why those words were used. Verse 17, Eli said, go in peace. She did. Then 19, they rose in the morning and worship God. So they're just there. They do seem to be a worshiping, trusting family, and they know where to go with pain. Came about due time, and after Hannah had conceived, verse 20, that she gave birth to a son and named him Samuel, saying, because I've asked of the Lord. Then, not a new transition. Then the man Elkanah went up to his house home to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice. And this is where we see her not go yet. Okay, and we already read that, so I'm not going to keep going over it. Verse 26, she explains herself to Eli. For the boy I prayed for, and the Lord has given me my petition when asked of him, so I have dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he has dedicated the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there. So this is where he was left. And it's interesting as we go on to see where Samuel is in the middle of all this. So we come to Samuel 2, and
chapter 2. And Hannah prayed and said, my heart exults in the Lord, my strength is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord. There is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne seven, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness, for not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed. Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy ministered to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. The custom of the priests with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw. And if the man said to him, let them burn the fat first, and then take as much as you wish, he would say, no, you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force. Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord. for the man treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy clothed with a linen ephod. And his mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord." So then they would return to their home. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and bore 3 sons and 2 daughters. And the young man Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. Now Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who were serving the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, it is no good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. Now the young man Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord, and also with man. And there came a man of God to Eli and said to him, "Thus the Lord has said, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? I gave to the house of your father all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded, and honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? Therefore the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promised that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house. There will not be an old man in your house. Then in distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel. And there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. And this that shall come upon your 2 sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be the sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed forever. And everyone who is left in your house shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and shall say, please put me in one of the priest's places, that I may eat a morsel of bread. Chapter 3. Now the young man Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli. And the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, was lying down in his own place. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. Then the Lord called Samuel, and he said, "Here I am," and ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call. Lie down again." So he went and lay down. And the Lord called again, "Samuel." And Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call, my son. Lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. The Lord called Samuel again the 3rd time, and he arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." Then Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the young man. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go, lie down, and if he calls you, you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. And the Lord came and stood, calling as at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant hears." Then the Lord said to Samuel, Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel at which the two ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. On that day I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. And I declare to him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew, because his sons were blaspheming God, and he did not restrain them. Therefore I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. Samuel lay until morning. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord. And Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. But Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. And he said, Here I am. And Eli said, What was it that he told you? Do not hide it from me. May God do so to you, and more also, if you hide anything from me of all that he told you. So Samuel told him everything, and hid nothing from him. And he said, It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. And Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. The Lord appeared again at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord.
Those are two different things, and yet they're in the same story. So why would God be showing me this? Why would God show me first this child as growing, ministering to the Lord in the temple or wherever he is in Shiloh, versus these sons who are actually going to grow up and supposed to be the priests in this same building, the same place, and they're worthless? Why did God tell me that? Is he gossiping?
Oh, there's a lesson in there somewhere.
We all have choice.
Mm-hmm. You've got a plan. Mm-hmm.
No matter what you've been given, you still have a choice with what you're going to do in that.
And you can go through the motions and not know the Lord?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. Mm-hmm. And so there's several things on that one, isn't there? The several things are, is it enough? It's not enough, is it, to go through the motions? So God's not done with Samuel yet.
Well, his purposes aren't thwarted, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And we even see that with Eli, don't we?
And those sons were changing what they were supposed to be doing.
So, okay, so stop for a minute and think about something. And you can think about the time before you were a believer. Believer means you knew the gospel and you followed Jesus Christ. Did you know there was a God? Well, you need to think about this yourself. Did you know there was a God? And if you did, how did that affect how you acted in things? I remember one day thinking about a pastor that I knew going, I don't think he could believe in God, because if he did, he would know that God's going to hold him accountable to this stuff. So even as a non-Christian, I knew there was a God. I didn't quite know him, and I really didn't know his words, so I didn't know what to expect, but I knew there was a God. And of course, you have your own opinions of what that means, but he's a big guy. He's bigger than you are. That much I knew. I don't think these guys believe that far, because they have absolutely no fear of doing whatever they want to do. So what are they standing on? I mean, what are the Jews today standing on? They are the chosen people. Well, did they miss something in that?
I don't think so.
Kind of big stuff, huh? Okay, so those are the things, some of the things to think about. You'll think of your own things. Where is the next transition? Verse 17 says, the sin of the young man was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord. You said 18?
Yeah, Samuel was ministering as a boy wearing a linen ephod. So in my mind, I'm wondering, okay, is that significant?
I looked up ephod, so I'll let you guys do that. We'll talk about that next week. I'm not sure what it was for this boy to be wearing an ephod, to tell you the truth.
What is an ephod?
In Jewish history, the priest would wear a shirt vest thing on top, and it would have jewels of each one of the tribes of Israel, and it was only the priest who wore it. That's not what he's wearing. He's wearing like a shirt. But it is still a shirt.
His mother is making and bringing.
And it's a shirt set aside for a priest. So he is in the temple. Does this mean that they're looking at him? No, they don't look at him like a priest, but he's sort of a priest in process. Again, God doesn't tell us these parts of the story. So, I mean, we can speculate, but we can't sit on the speculation because we don't know. We don't know his age. We can't sit on what that is. Yeah.
According to the next verse where the mother is bringing a little robe, it sounds to me like this linen thing maybe was placed over the robe. That's speculation.
Yeah, because it's a top. It's like even with the priest, it was a top that went over things. But
I bet she was at least potty trained.
Well, if he wasn't at this stage, Eli had a real mess on his hands, didn't he? Now we know why she gave in to Eli. You do it.
Also, Judges 18:31, he says that the house of God is in Shiloh.
Okay.
So,
why? Well, I'm not sure
I
it was the tabernacle yet.
I read somewhere that it was the tabernacle.
The house of God.
Well, yeah, because what is the tabernacle, Bonnie?
That was one that they could set up and take down.
Right.
Like a tent.
Which is what they carried through the wilderness. I don't know what, as far as I know, when they built the permanent thing was Solomon, and I don't really know how anything before that was a permanent thing.
Yeah, in Jerusalem.
Well, in verse 9 of chapter 1, it says Eli was, the priest was sitting on the
right
by the doorpost of the temple.
Which is
that man.
Translation, so I'm going to look up those words and figure out if that's what it really means.
What
temple is there?
Yeah.
We can't, like, it's... Whenever we read temple in the Old Testament, often the church translates that into the church. It's not the church. So we have to think about what is it. Well, this is the chosen place for the...
For the priest.
For, as Bonnie said, for the whole... This is where they worshipped. And they probably had their tent, and I don't know what that is. And I don't know why the word temple is there either, so I'm going to look that up. So I'm trying to understand it. But I know that his position is that if there was a temple, which may also answer some of these questions, why that woman was there. Because she wasn't on the inside, she was on the outside, and she was allowed on the outside. Anyway. So you had me at verse 18. You had Samuel ministry. He was wearing a ephod. What else was on in that section before we have the next transition?
Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife, and ask the Lord to give them more children.
So here we go. Here is this priest who is not being particularly healthy picture. Still, the Lord is answering. The Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to three sons. Why do you suppose God allowed that transition? Why does God allow Eli to bless her, and then the blessing comes? What is the Lord saying about that? Do we know?
He has to be okay with it that he's allowing it after.
Because what do we know about priests?
They were God's chosen.
And they were born into that. And evidently they don't have to be perfect. Should they want to be? Should they be trying to be? Why do you think God keeps showing us the picture of Samuel? He keeps showing us Samuel seeking God, worshiping. In fact, we're going to see him in a little while laying in the temple beside the altar. That's where he sleeps. Like, whoa. Anyway, okay. So, and verse 21 is another transition. Well, we see it. Samuel grew before the Lord. So he keeps growing before the Lord, doesn't he? Ministering, growing. Then we come to 22. What is 22 on about?
Eli and his old age and his sons.
Those wicked sons. And what does he say to his sons in verse 23?
Why are you doing this?
So, who's in charge of that discussion? Your parents, you guys, most of you in here, not all of you are parents, but most of you are parents. And if I say to my sons, why are you doing this? Am I disciplining them? Am I giving them a direction? Do I have a line drawn in the sand saying, you will not pass this because God has... I'm saying, buck up and be good! But that's not taking a stand. I know that because of what the Lord says later. Because when you read it, you think, well, he's trying, isn't he? Not really.
I thought he was just asking, why are you being such rats?
Well, and I also think that the people are seeing this, and that shows on me. So who does this become about again? It becomes about me, not about you, not about God. You're concerned about God, and you know that somebody who is in the position of a priest, which they are, is living an immoral situation. Do you allow that?
But they're pretty old by this time.
Yeah.
And he failed to do it when they were really young, and so now it's a little late because they don't respect, obviously,
yeah,
godly
principles. Yeah, but he has a position. And that position, besides father, is head priest. You don't let people come up in the priesthood who are living like that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, early on, but
I think he could have. Could have said, you can no longer be a priest.
Well, biblically, what was he supposed to be doing? Stoning them.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't want him stoned, but nevertheless, God is showing him, are you choosing your children, your position, or me? And he's not choosing God. And that's what we begin to see, because that is part of the story that we're analyzing. We begin to see that God is presenting. Because he's giving us a contrast. What is the contrast with Samuel? So you look at this, and you look at this contrast. Because it started out, well, Hannah and the other wife is a contrast, right? Eli's sons and Samuel. Eli and Elkanah. That's a contrast. We're beginning to see contrast that God is developing so that we can understand this story. Anything anybody wants to add?
Well, you think, you know, you see Eli giving the sons a warning. Eli knew, and he was giving a warning, but he didn't know what was in his power to do to correct the situation.
I think, as parents, the most difficult thing is saying difficult things, especially to your adult children. And I think this needs to be a picture for us. So ask yourselves, you go through this, what did God want from Eli? Because he went too far, and it went on too long, and he lost them. And the question, I think, becomes, are you going to choose your children, or are you going to choose me? And anybody who's had children who are wayward as adults knows it's the most difficult thing in the world, because oftentimes they're grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And by the time the grandchildren come, you have no perfect answer. But you still have to say, how, God, do I choose you in the midst of this? How? I don't know how. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm being a faithful parent and grandparent. But I know right now it looks like I'm choosing them over you. And I don't know how to live that. So that's a question we ask ourselves and we seek. So let's see how the story develops, if it helps us answer that question. Because we're in the middle of the story.
Well, and this story is a bit different than like our personal stories. Because in this story, Eli is the main priest. And so it's his responsibility. If his sons were, Hophni and Phinehas were living in a neighboring village and they were doing these things, then of course he'd still be asking the same kind of questions. Why are you doing this kind of thing? But he's the main priest.
He's developing the next generation of
priests.
And they're performing in the temple under him.
Yes. And so he would be accountable, whether it's his children, whether it's Samuel, whether it's...
Well, it goes back to that same thing, doesn't it? He even called Samuel his son, even though we know he doesn't mean he's his son. He's in that position, too. Yeah. So.
Well, it's obviously God's plan for Samuel to be in the house of the Lord and to be trained up in the house of the Lord. But what I find weird or unusual is, why would God put Samuel in this place, in this environment, to be trained up? Under wicked people, because you know the sons had seemed to have as much influence with the sacrifices and the workings of the temple and or the house of the Lord as Eli did.
I think those are things that we need to think about in the sense of a bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And one that comes in there is Joseph to me, and the choices he made, and how could he have made those choices that he didn't seem to have really good witnesses in that sense. So, you know, people always ask the question, is this, and I'm not going to say it right because I don't ask the question, is this genetics, is this heritage, or is this, personal choice? Well, I think there's a lot in there that you can have good kids, godly kids come out of ungodly family situations, and ungodly kids come out of godly family situations. And you just sit there, because I know, at least this is the way I thought, I know that I thought if I did everything right,
me too,
when my children were young, they were going to love and adore the Lord. Guess what? Didn't happen. Yes. How did that happen?
Free will.
I would have bet my life on it, because I thought it's 1 + 1 = 2, but it isn't. And that's taking God out of the mix. That's just following rules. That's doing exactly what the Gentiles do. So we learn from this, and we watch God, and we raise our children with open hands, and we live the example rather than just giving them words. Because the words mean nothing if they don't see the example. And if they see the example and reject it, they are held accountable. So, we have 15 minutes. Any questions so far? Not just about the story, but the process.
The story about the, I think, when I see myself, it's a personal decision. You know, we grew up in learning the cultures of how parents are grown up watching them. But it's no matter how bad brother says the wrong thing, my own decision, I want to get to see that. I want to get to who is best. And I find this own decision making, this or that story thing. Samuel has it, like, he don't believe in God, right? He doesn't know the God.
He believes there is a God, he just doesn't know him.
But he don't know the God.
But he wouldn't worship him.
So I grew up, same thing. I don't even know Jesus, who is Jesus. So I fell in love with the song to come to that. The almost like a choice. Mm-hmm. It's my own choice, my decision. I don't know that God in a personal relationship. That's why I come to that, you know, that I don't know the things in the Bible, all that. English and all that. Mm-hmm. Very difficult. Even Korean translation is very difficult to do that. You get to know more and more. To me, myself, you know, I don't know much. When I reading the things and all of them, I go back there again, read them, and I kind of, it's not a good thing. I understand what that meant. It matters each personal the relationship, the decision. That's all I got.
And that's why we know that it's, I mean, you can have 10 kids in the same household, it's when God calls, is when they're going to come to know Him. And I can't make that happen as much as I would like to make it happen. And then, so what does that teach me about me? About you?
There's the verse that says, no one can come to me unless the Father draws him. And we've been drawn and made a choice to say yes.
And basically, for me in raising my kids, I can only raise them as I would believe following the Lord looks like. I can't be something else. I can't get inside their souls, inside their heads. I have to be faithful, and the one I'm faithful to first is the Lord. And I will be imperfect in that because I'm growing. I mean, I feel sorry for my kids. I had them when I was a 5-year-old Christian, you know? I've learned a little since then, but that's all part of our growing process. It's all part of our getting our eyes off of each other and turning our eyes onto Him. And that's why we look at this. This is what we're learning. We're learning to turn our eyes on Him, because you look at that and think, how did Samuel come out of that? Well, he did. How come Phinehas and whatever his name is, not follow the Lord? Well, you can say, yeah, he didn't have a good example, but others have not had good examples.
So Samuel passed books as a break of Samuel or son?
Yeah.
That's why it can be Samuel.
Could that be what my job is?
I pray my kids all the time. So,
and I think that is the lesson we learned from Hannah. I think lesson Hannah learned from I mean, why did God wait so long for her to have children? Because there was a lesson she was learning too. And she was the heart that was seeking the Lord. The other wife may have had all the kids, but who was seeking the Lord? And which would you rather have?
She had a concentrated time with him, which was good. And I'm sure she readied him for going there. And then she didn't see him all year long, so she had to trust him to the Lord. But she still put a little input by bringing in that coat. You know, so, I mean, we can kind of take lessons from that we just keep loving on our kids and
keep entering their world
when we can, but
that's a lot.
Trust God, too.
Well, and
yes,
if
ma'am.
And the question is, farther along we're going to learn that Samuel's sons were not believers.
Oh, they did the same thing.
They did so the same thing happened to Samuel, and yet he had seen what happened to Eli and his sons. The question is, why did it? What happened there?
So hopefully by the time we get there, we'll have figured that out at least. But right now we can't because we don't know the stories in between. Not to be so hard on ourselves, too, because we are in process. If we are seeking the Lord, and we are seeking the Lord, I mean, you're not coming to Bible study because you want to do these easy Bible studies. I don't let you do easy Bible studies, so you're not coming for that reason.
Amen.
So we're seeking the Lord, but we're not seeking Him perfectly. And the Lord knows that. And He is developing us. And it may take years for us to be the person we are. And maybe it's in the lives of our grandchildren or our neighbors or Christ.
I think at a prayer talk yesterday, she saw the Bible. She said, are you a missionary?
Well, yes. Once you have a seat, I have something to tell you. Okay. Let's just pray. I'm going to open this because we have 10 minutes left, and I could go on reading, but really, we're going to study it. We haven't studied it yet, so we'll do that for next week. But let's have some quiet prayer, and then I'll close it up.